The Kennedys were fun and had a lot of glamour. We thought they belonged in Hollywood, not Washington. Richards was wary of talking to police. He had heard no disturbance from the senator's room on the night of the accident. His conversation with Ted Kennedy the next morning had been about the previous day's regatta, he said. I happened to win the race, and he congratulated me on it. And we discussed that back and forth for maybe 10-15 minutes. Stanmore had also participated in the discussion. Richards had observed nothing out of the ordinary about the senator's speech or appearance. Kennedy hadn't mentioned the accident. I remember the bell at 8 o'clock. We asked the senator if he would like to have breakfast with us. He said he couldn't, but he might join us later. Kennedy had looked startled when Paul Markham and Joe Gargan showed up, soaking wet. The three men went into the senator's room. Richards heard an argument going on. But as to what it was about, I don't know. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Dunn said, that Kennedy was finding out about the accident for the first time. According to the report of the interrogation Dunn submitted to George Killen, Richards replied, It sure looked that way. But Richards didn't tell police any more than he had to, Stanmore said. Ross was making faces whenever the accident was mentioned. He knew something had gone on. Richards had refused to discuss how much Ted Kennedy had to drink at a victory party on his boat after the regatta race. Neither would Moore.
We weren't going to be the ones to stick Ted Kennedy with a drunk driving charge, if that's what police were looking for, Moore said.
When Killen came to his automobile agency to interrogate him, the police asked me if the senator seemed nervous when I saw him on Saturday. All I can say is he looked all right to me. Kennedy had made some innocuous remarks. Things like, what a beautiful day, and isn't this a lovely place? He didn't mention Chappaquiddick at all. Moore refused to talk about drinking. I was asked that question many, many times, but I have no comment, Moore said later. I didn't think it was anybody's business. Ted had 3 rum and cokes in about 20 minutes, but he wasn't laced or anything. Moore didn't tell Killen about his invitation to the cookout, or his view of the gathering as that kind of a party. As for the accident and its aftermath, I just thought it was a case of a stiff dick has no conscience. Killen added Moore and Richards to a list of witnesses to be called at the inquest. He was interested to find out if they would refuse to discuss liquor consumption under oath and risk contempt of court to protect Ted Kennedy. But Killen was baffled by the reports of Senator Kennedy's conduct on the porch of the Shiretown Inn on the morning after the accident. So was Bernie Flynn. Using Dunn's report as a basis, Flynn revised the scenario of probable events he'd put together after visiting Chappaquiddick with Huck Look. The new scenario went like this. After fleeing from his encounter with the deputy sheriff down Dyke Road, Kennedy had decided not to chance getting arrested for drunk driving, Flynn suggested. So he pulled over. He got out of the car and tells the girl to go down to the end of the road and come back to pick him up when the coast is clear. When she didn't show up, he thought she was stuck in the sand on the beach or got lost. He figures, well, I'll go back to the cottage. He tells Gargan and Markham what happened and asks to be taken to the landing. When he gets there, the ferry's closed down. He thinks, what the hell, I'll go back to the other side. He dives in and swims across. The people at the party hung around the cottage waiting for Mary Jo to come back with Kennedy's car. When they realize she's missing, they go looking for her. That's why everybody spent the night out there. It wasn't until morning Gargan and Markham spotted the car in the pond. They dive in to see if Mary Jo's in it, but they can't see anything. So they get on the ferry soaking wet and run like hell to the Shiretown Inn to tell Ted what happened. That's the first time he heard about the accident. Flynn based his theory on the fact that a man like Ted Kennedy, or any man except for a hardened criminal, could go through the experience of driving off a bridge and not report the accident if he knew that a girl was still in the car. I just can't believe Kennedy went to sleep, got up the next morning, and was standing on the deck, supposedly prepared to go yachting, talking to people about the weather like nothing was going to happen, if he knew the girl was dead. You'd stay in your damn hotel room. You'd be biting your fingernails trying to figure out, what am I going to do? What am I going to say? You'd expect to be locked up any minute, and you'd be frightened. As Flynn visualized the scene, Kennedy's talking to these people when Gargan and Markham show up. I think he received the information like, Ted, the car's in the water. And he gets this startled look. Then the three of them go into his room to discuss it. When they come out, Kennedy is shaken. This reaffirms my suspicion that this is the first time he knows the girl didn't make it back to the cottage. Kennedy's first impulse was to go to the scene of the accident to see for himself what had happened. Not because of any telephone. That sounded like a story to me, Flynn said. There were phones he could have used in Edgartown. There was no reason whatsoever for him to go to Chappaquiddick if he knew about the accident. What's he going to do? Look at the body and say, oh my God, she did stay in the car, she didn't get out? Flynn could only surmise why Kennedy had given an altogether different version of the accident in his police report. Not unless somebody said to him, we can make you look like a hero. You dove in, you tried to save her, you expended all your energy. He might have gone for that. That sounds pretty damn good. Everybody thought it was only a minor automobile accident. They didn't realize how it would mushroom. All they wanted to do was protect him from an embarrassing situation. Being drunk in a car with a girl late at night, parked on the road to the cemetery, Flynn said. Kennedy could have been there for an hour and a half getting laid, or gone someplace else after he left the cottage. That would account for the time difference with Huck Look seeing the car. If anything happened, it didn't happen at the beach. It had already happened. Kennedy's finished, and now he's ready to run. Once he made the police report, Kennedy was stuck with the story. Later, he had to compound the lie by elaborating on it in his television speech. Flynn said, Ted Kennedy wasn't in the car when it went off the bridge, in my opinion. He would never have gotten out alive. Killen tested Flynn's theory on Frank Keating, with variations of his own. When Kennedy drove to the intersection, he'd gone straight into Cemetery Road. That was deliberate. Kennedy wasn't confused. He did that when he saw Look pass in his car. And I suppose he said to the girl, that cop recognized me. I'm getting out. You drive back to the cottage. I'll walk. Mary Jo had driven off. Instead of going straight, she'd taken the wrong turn on Dyke Road, Killen said. That's why the details about the accident are so sketchy. Kennedy doesn't know what happened. If that was truth, Keating countered, why wasn't it less harmless to say that, rather than putting himself in the car, diving repeatedly and all the rest of it? Don't you think there's a strong possibility Ted was loaded? How much could he remember in detail except for finding himself in the water? In Killen's version, Kennedy took the last ferry to Edgartown, returned to the Shiretown Inn, and said to himself, to hell with it. I never should have been out with her in the first place. But Killen could not corroborate his theories. Gargan would have told him they didn't hold water. Police had no hope of questioning Gargan or anybody else who had attended the party, Flynn said. Everybody was represented by counsel. Once somebody gets a lawyer, you can't go to them and say, I want to question you. You have to go to the attorney. It was rare in Flynn's experience that a witness hired a lawyer. Rarer still was the district attorney's office writing letters asking witnesses to talk to police. Armand Fernandez confirmed, the letters we sent to the people involved received uniform answers that under Miranda they refused to talk to police. Denise had not received an answer to his request for an inquest when he called on Attorney General Robert Quinn in Boston. A delegate to the 1968 Democratic Convention pledged to Eugene McCarthy. Denise proposed at the first Massachusetts caucus a resolution committing the delegation's 82 votes to Ted Kennedy, should the convention go to a second ballot, as seemed likely. As the delegation's vice chairman, Quinn had gaveled Denise out of order, a move interpreted as in accord with Ted Kennedy's instructions not to encourage a draft. Denise suggested Quinn take over the inquest as the state's chief law enforcement officer. Quinn nearly fell out of his chair, Denise reported later. He said no, no. He was terrified. Although Denise had brought up the subject, Quinn had no intention of becoming involved in the Kennedy accident, Quinn told reporters. I have no more information now than I had 3 weeks ago that would require me to enter the case. Quinn was leaving Denise to his decision to hold an inquest, although his cooperation was extended to him, as it was to any district attorney in the Commonwealth. "I've done a lot of research in the matter. Legal research," Quinn emphasized to subdue speculation that, as a political ally of Ted Kennedy, he had discouraged an inquiry by the Edgartown grand jury and ordered Police Chief Arena to keep your mouth shut and discontinue his twice-a-day press briefings. But Quinn had made it clear where his sentiments were after the senator's speech. Urging Ted Kennedy to remain in office, he said, "Let us hope that in the deep resources of his human capabilities, he can again redouble his efforts in service to the people." Denise was in Quinn's office when Judge Boyle's reply to his request for an inquest arrived in New Bedford. The gist of the letter was read to Denise over the telephone by Armand Fernandez. Boyle wanted to know if Denise was exercising his mandatory power to require an inquest be held, and intended to submit evidence that an unlawful act or negligence caused or contributed to the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, contrary to the report of the medical examiner. Denise regarded the response as satisfactory, and predicted an inquest could begin within a week to 10 days. "All I'm trying to do is conduct a general inquiry into a situation that should be looked into a little further," Denise told reporters on the sidewalk in front of his law offices when he returned to New Bedford. "We want to learn as much as we can about the incident from the people who were in the area at the time, so as to determine exactly what the facts were. All persons present prior to the death of the girl, and anyone else who can assist the Commonwealth, will be called to testify." Denise had made no determination about calling Senator Kennedy yet. As part of the inquest, Denise was seeking to have Mary Jo Kopechne's body exhumed. In order to have a pathologist perform an examination and once and for all close that aspect of the case. His office was researching legal procedures required to secure a belated autopsy. A public clamor had prompted a new look into the case, Denise told Blythe Evans, district attorney for Luzerne County in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Denise wanted to know what practices and procedures were required to have an exhumation performed in his county. Like Denise, Evans was, at 36, the youngest man to hold the office. A Republican, he had squeaked to a 150-vote surprise victory in a heavily Democratic district. Evans made sure his constituents knew about his lack of enthusiasm for the idea. Denise had to prove in his own state that an autopsy was necessary, he said. "I regard this as a major hurdle for Denise. After all, there has been a medical finding in this case that went unchallenged and was accepted until now. I definitely will not do anything of my own volition. If a court of appropriate jurisdiction in Massachusetts hands down an order, then we are ready to cooperate. Everything will be done by the book." But Evans knew even less about Massachusetts law than Denise did about Pennsylvania procedure. Pennsylvania's coroner system required permission from the court to perform autopsies. Massachusetts district attorneys had authority to secure an autopsy on their own authority. All Denise had to do was ask that an autopsy be made under the relevant Massachusetts statutes, then wait for a Pennsylvania court to accede to Section 1, Article 4 of the U.S. Constitution, which requires states to give full faith and credit to the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of every other state. On the surface, it looked easy. Reality would prove otherwise. Fernandez was preparing a petition, asking Pennsylvania to honor the Massachusetts law, granting the district attorney's authority to order autopsies. Evans insisted, "It's a court order we're looking for, not a petition." For Pennsylvania courts to grant exhumation, it should be shown there were imperative reasons to disturb the sanctity of the grave. The wishes of the deceased's family were always taken into account. Autopsies could be performed against their opposition if there was a suspicion that a serious crime had been committed. Denise was fairly confident of getting an autopsy. He had been studying Pennsylvania law and concluded that not much weight was given to family objections. He hadn't talked to the Kopechnes about exhuming their daughter's body, he said. "I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't want to bother them. They have enough trouble." Gwen Kopechne confirmed, "Mr. Denise never bothered to consult us. We've never heard a word. We've been left out of this as if it didn't matter who we are.
Mrs. Kopechne was under the impression an autopsy had already been performed.
We were told everything has been taken care of. I'm pretty positive it was somebody from Mr. Denise's office. I don't know why in 2 weeks they decide to hold an autopsy. Maybe I'm a foolish person, but I just can't see this at all. Not after we buried her.
Nor, since the funeral, had the Kopechnes heard from another key figure, Senator Kennedy.
We have had no collusion with the Kennedys at all, not even information. They didn't bother to tell us anything.
She added, however, that Kennedy's aide, Dunn Gifford, had paid a number of visits.
He'd make a trip all the way to our home to tell us there was going to be something in the newspapers, maybe by Jack Anderson or somebody else that might hurt us, Mrs. Kopechne said. We thought that was nice, because we were prepared for it.
What Gifford wanted the Kopechnes prepared for were two Anderson columns scheduled to appear in the Washington Post and other newspapers, in which the syndicated columnist had pieced together from Kennedy intimates who would have no reason to falsify the facts, what had happened on the night of the accident. Senator Kennedy had done his share of drinking at the party, but intimates insisted he wasn't drunk. He'd invited Mary Jo for a midnight swim, deliberately turned onto Dyke Road heading for East Beach, and hit the bridge going 20 miles per hour. Too fast for safety, and shot off the side of the bridge without skidding, Anderson said. Kennedy escaped from the car and made repeated dives to rescue his passenger. After it was too late to save Mary Jo, he felt it might still be possible to save his presidential dream, Anderson wrote. Exhausted and in panic, Kennedy had rested beside Poca Pond. In this state, he conceived a preposterous, absurd idea. He would ask his cousin, Joe Gargan, to take the rap for him. Gargan had always been there when the Kennedys needed him. Although a lawyer, he was more a handyman who ran the errands and attended to arrangements for the Kennedys. Gargan agreed to say he had driven the car and returned to Dyke Bridge to familiarize himself with the scene of his accident. It is entirely possible that Markham and Gargan attempted to retrieve the girl's body, Anderson said. Then Gargan and Markham rustled up a boat and delivered Kennedy to the other side. The idea was to remove the senator from the site of the accident. Kennedy had slipped unnoticed into the Shiretown Inn and established an alibi by talking to a room clerk. When Gargan and Markham had arrived at the inn the next morning, they had assumed they were the only ones who knew about the accident. They wanted another look at the scene in daylight. As they were crossing the channel, however, someone mentioned that a car had been found bottom up in Poca Pond. A shaken Ted Kennedy had walked off to get hold of his emotions, telephoned Burke Marshall, then reported the accident to Edgartown police. Kennedy's hope to avoid blame had occurred during a nightmare of emotional trauma, Anderson explained. But in the end, he abandoned the scheme and manfully owned up to what he had done. There were no rowboats, as reported by Anderson, Gargan said later. I wish to hell there had been. Then we would have been with him after he dove in the water. Publicly, Gargan denied any truth in Anderson's columns. There's no basis in fact whatsoever for the report. It's entirely untrue. But Gargan was bothered Anderson had cited Kennedy intimates as sources. Knowledgeable in the art of media control as practiced by the Kennedy political apparatus, he suspected misinformation about the accident probably had come from friends, anxious to explain away the senator's misbehavior. The reports had trivialized Gargan's dangerous rescue effort. The handyman reference was especially galling, but revealing of certain staff sentiments about him. Gargan made a good living as an able trial lawyer. His work in Kennedy campaigns had been voluntary and unpaid. The efforts to mislead the press about the incident were well-intentioned, Gargan recognized. I don't think anybody was trying deliberately to hurt Paul and me by these stories. They were only interested in protecting the senator. The speculation that Gargan had agreed to take blame for the accident came to him from Time magazine, Anderson said later. Their files contained this same report. I can't say Time bought it, because they didn't use it. Anderson was working hard on one of the great political stories of all time, he said,
He had Jack Olson as leg man in Edgartown gathering information on the case. Jack was representing me on the short side and working on a book on the long range. In defending his columns, Anderson conceded Kennedy intimates might have fed him misinformation to protect the senator and throw the press off the track of the case, he said. Those things are possible. We only know what our sources tell us. That's the best we can do. Chapter 39. As a result of Anderson's reports, however, C. Remington Ballew of Providence, Rhode Island, contacted the New Bedford Standard-Times, because I thought someone should know what we had seen. In Edgartown for the regatta, Ballew's Concordia Yawl Sumatra was moored in the harbor close by the ferry channel. A little before 2 a.m. on July 19th, Ballew overheard a hushed conversation from the forms of three persons passing by in a boat that doused its lights and outboard motor. Then, a larger boat with a powerful engine left Edgartown, crossing the channel to a beach near the Chappaquiddick Landing, and also shut off lights and motor, Ballew related. At this point, the small boat was drifting, pointed towards the beach and the larger boat. It seemed to be waiting, like somebody casing the area to see all was quiet. 5 minutes later, the small boat's motor started up again. Lights were turned on, and it moved out of the harbor. Dick Drane denied the story. If there was a boat, he wasn't on it. The senator swam across. Pending the inquest, Senator Kennedy would have nothing more to say about the accident, other than to characterize the Anderson columns as categorically untrue. Kennedy had no idea why such allegations should be published, but he was disturbed by reports he had planned to lie about his involvement to protect his political future, and had left the scene of the accident while there was still a chance Mary Jo Kopechne was alive in his car. Kennedy conceded he may have made a mistake in not going beyond his television explanation, but cited legal restraints and the current rumor-filled atmosphere for not going into more detail now. Kennedy might talk more about the accident after all legal proceedings were concluded. He said, I can live with myself. I feel the tragedy of the girl's death. That's on my mind. That's what I will always have to live with. But what I don't have to live with are the whispers and innuendos and falsehoods, because these have no basis in fact. Kennedy described himself as comfortable back in the Senate. Some thought otherwise. He is ill at ease and far from the commanding figure he had developed before the accident. Kennedy was ashen-faced, tortured eyes looking out tentatively for signs of loyalty or defection. Slouched in his whip's chair, distracted and preoccupied, Kennedy retained a gaunt hangdog expression. Kennedy's staff was maintaining an almost manic gaiety throughout the crisis, coping with a flood of hate mail. Sponsors of some events had withdrawn invitations for the senator to appear. His unsatisfactory explanation for the accident had been responsible for a climate of gloom and defeatism inside the Democratic Party. Kennedy acknowledged the hard going he was having to Jimmy Smith, thanking him for his thoughtful messages and very kind letter. He said, I just wanted you to know how much I appreciate your warm expressions of friendship and support. It's good friends like you that have made this difficult period a bit easier for me. On Friday, August 8th, Denise flew to Edgartown in a chartered seaplane, landing at a beach on Chappaquiddick. Denise boarded the On Time for Edgartown. He was met at the courthouse steps by reporters and Judge Boyle. Denise was led to Boyle's second-floor chambers for a private conference. For Denise to have asked the Superior Court to preside at an inquest was a direct slap at Boyle's court, a contempt Denise had never hidden. When Boyle had directed 15 straight not-guilty verdicts, because Island police didn't know how to present evidence in trials, Denise cited an increase in crime on Martha's Vineyard to widespread contempt for law enforcement, because Island police failed to obtain convictions in court. Boyle returned Denise's hostile feelings in kind, regarding the district attorney as an ambitious opportunist, whose entry into the Kennedy accident case was the latest in a series of publicity stunts to advance his political career. But Boyle had also been offended by the noble posturing of Senator Kennedy in his television speech. by speaking of his moral obligation to plead guilty to leaving the scene, Kennedy had suggested he could not have been found legally guilty of the charge. In addition, the senator, in his speech, had dredged up the medical defense Dick McCarran tentatively broached at the arraignment, which had angered Boyle in court. But Boyle was even more mistrustful of Denise's motives in calling for an inquest, which he made abundantly plain to Denise at their meeting. For what purpose was the district attorney seeking a new inquiry? Denise wanted to put to rest all the rumors and speculation about the accident, he said. A district attorney who had evidence to proceed against a possible defendant conducted a private, not a public investigation, the results of which led him to drop the matter or seek an indictment, Boyle said. Most states had reciprocal agreements for witnesses to appear before a grand jury. Out-of-state witnesses were not bound to honor a summons to an inquest, Boyle pointed out. Denise might have trouble getting witnesses to testify, if they didn't choose to appear voluntarily. Denise ruled out a grand jury. He wanted to avoid any intimation of criminality by his reopened investigation. But Boyle wasn't buying the argument. Taking the case to a grand jury was tantamount to seeking a prosecution. By requiring an inquest to be held, Denise was placing responsibility for an investigation and any charges that might come out of the inquest onto the court. Furious to be lectured about his motives, Denise had questions about Boyle's. By discouraging an inquest, Boyle was seeking to protect his jurisdiction from accusations, quite correct ones in Denise's opinion, that Edgartown authorities had bungled the case so badly the district attorney's office had been forced to take over. Arena's investigation had given a new dimension to ineptitude. Walter Steele had rolled over and played dead, his plea bargaining so facile as to have been viewed by the press as a fix. Kennedy's trial was a farce. For Boyle to suspend a 20-day mandatory jail sentence wasn't even legal. That Boyle wasn't disqualifying himself from presiding at the inquest was further proof, if Denise needed any more, of a determination to protect his judicial turf from outsiders and keep the Kennedy accident an Edgartown case. Boyle appeared in judicial robes before an audience of reporters in the courtroom to announce an inquest into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, to be held on Wednesday, September 3rd. The statute permitted the exclusion of all not required to attend. But Boyle was exercising judicial discretion by allowing legitimate and accredited members of the press, television, radio, or other news media in the courtroom. A decision Harvey Ewing regarded as consistent with Boyle's policy of open courtroom, he said. For weeks, media people have been scrounging around Edgartown for any tidbit about the Kennedy accident they could find, and pretty much getting nowhere. But an open inquest. Now that was a story to whet journalistic appetites. Denise had more modest expectations for what an inquest could accomplish. The scope of his inquiry was to make an effort to establish for the official record all the facts surrounding the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Denise would call as many witnesses as we know about, everyone involved. With regard to Senator Kennedy, however, he had no intention of calling him at this time. A declaration guaranteed to provoke doubts about how thorough the inquest would be, if Denise really believed he could bypass the driver of the car and the only eyewitness to the accident. To many reporters, such reticence suggested Denise was more interested in going through the motions than uncovering the accident's unsolved mysteries. Although Denise wasn't calling Kennedy to the inquest, Arena was arranging to provide police protection for the senator anyway, he explained. That's what he said today. But if you know that guy, you know we have to arrange for every possibility. Denise widened a credibility gap when he visited the accident site to pronounce Dyke Bridge a traffic hazard. He said, "It's understandable that in the middle of the night, an automobile could easily go off the bridge if the person who approached it wasn't aware it was there, and that it veered off sharply to the left. The angle is quite acute." Denise was letting Ted Kennedy off the hook before a single piece of evidence had been heard at the inquest, in the view of some reporters. Having demanded Denise engage in further investigation, now that he was doing it, the press got all over his back for picking on Ted Kennedy, F. Lee Bailey observed. Bailey's appearance at the accident site excited speculation Denise had asked his friend to look into the case. Bailey was considering a commission from the Ladies' Home Journal to write something about Chappaquiddick. After flying over Dyke Bridge in a helicopter, Bailey hung a movie camera out of the window of an automobile driven by his private investigator, Andy Tooney, to photograph the route from the cottage to the bridge, to try to reconstruct the probable circumstances of the accident. Bailey crossed over the bridge, peered thoughtfully into Poca Pond, and posed for photographs. He concluded the accident wasn't anything that he could write about, he said. I didn't think a trial lawyer jumping in with speculation that would level the finger of suspicion at Senator Kennedy would be my cup of tea, and I'd rather not get involved. But Bailey, and in particular his investigator, would become involved beyond anything they could have imagined, setting in motion a scheme to prevent any information contrary to Ted Kennedy's two public accountings of the accident being revealed at the inquest. While required to demonstrate the impartiality of the law and to quell the disturbing, not unreasonable impression that public officials had not followed their usual course in dealing with the Kennedy case, Denise's unusual choice of a public inquest without a formal charge or the legal restrictions of a trial could turn into a punitive venture against Senator Kennedy, unless conducted with great care, the Standard Times warned. Denise was quick to point out the decision to permit the press in the courtroom was Judge Boyle's. The statute is very clear about that, Denise said. It says the court will decide. Senator Kennedy left it to his press secretary to remind reporters of his earlier pledge to cooperate in any way with an inquest, a declaration as far from the truth as it was possible to be. The prospect of a public inquisition, of testimony put under a daily press microscope, was intolerable and dangerous. But for Kennedy to decline to participate in an open inquiry was a dilemma for a public man. He couldn't refuse on the basis of the presence of the press in the courtroom. Some other pretext for enjoining the inquest under the auspices Boyle had decided had to be found. Kennedy was more candid about the initiatives undertaken to secure an exhumation and belated autopsy of Mary Jo Kopechne. He could have been talking about himself when he said, "I hope there will be no more grief for the girl's family." In the interest of speed, and to avoid procedural delay, Denise sent his petition to secure an exhumation and belated autopsy of Mary Jo Kopechne to the Common Pleas Court of Luzerne County by certified mail. Rather than based upon Fourth Amendment grounds, Denise had constructed an elaborate rationale to justify his late entry into the case. An autopsy was required, so the circumstances of death be clearly established, and the doubt and suspicion surrounding the case be resolved, Denise said. The senator's report to Edgartown police had differed from his television broadcast, both statements silent on many important details immediately preceding and following the accident. Persons with knowledge of the event had not called authorities, and within hours after the report to police, had left Edgartown, and since that time had been unavailable for questioning. If Denise hesitated to impute criminal implications in seeking a new inquiry, he did not hesitate to do so in his petition. The purpose of the inquest was to determine whether there was any reason to believe that the sudden death of Mary Jo Kopechne may have resulted from the act of negligence of a person or persons other than the deceased. After weeks of pussyfooting around the issue, Denise was sounding the alarm. His petition didn't need to mention any names. The finger of accusation was being pointed at Ted Kennedy. Denise asked Dr. Robert Nevin to co-sign the petition. "Because I've favored an autopsy all along," Nevin said. "An autopsy would have been distinctly to the advantage of Senator Kennedy, by putting to an end a lot of shabby rumors and thrown light on many obscure and debated facts." In Nevin's opinion, Dr. Mills committed an error in judgment in not excluding foul play before signing a death certificate. Nevin described him as a sweet, gentle, kind person who hooks rugs and plays the organ. He won't take a stand unless pushed. Mills was proud to hook rugs, he said. Nevin was a strange man, twice married, who doesn't make friends and has formed an opinion in this case without knowing the facts. Mills had talked with Denise and his aides numerous times since the accident. It was crystal clear to me that the district attorney wished to keep out of this case completely. 2 weeks later, Denise had dropped his hands-off policy and was seeking to exhume the body of Mary Jo Kopechne for autopsy, a procedure that would probably settle public clamor. But that's all it would accomplish. I've always been led to believe an autopsy after embalming is a pretty futile affair. An autopsy would have spared Mills being accused of having been bought off by Kennedy money, a charge made in crank letters he'd been getting, mainly from California, he said. If the district attorney's office had gotten into this thing the moment they heard the word Kennedy, and if they had backed me up rather than leaving me out on a limb, much of my ordeal could have been avoided. That medical examiner can't pass the buck to me, Denise charged back. Dr. Mills has tried from the first day to shift responsibility for his actions to the district attorney's office. He had full authority himself to order an autopsy, and he didn't. Denise turned up the heat under the stew of controversy bubbling over the lack of an autopsy in the case. On Sunday after the accident, I ordered Lieutenant George Killen to call the state pathologist, but the medical examiner had already released the body, Denise said. Killen had been in touch with Eugene Fry and been informed that arrangements had been made to fly the body off the island at 9:30 a.m. Mills found it strange that this should come out at this time, because of a number of telephone conversations he'd had with Denise. In none of these did he ever mention an autopsy. Killen refused to become embroiled in the controversy. The answer to these and many other questions will come to light during the inquest, he said. I don't believe in trial by newspaper. But Killen was appalled Denise should fabricate a story to defend himself against the charge he had been derelict in failing to execute his statutory authority to order an autopsy. Denise hadn't mentioned a pathologist on Sunday morning, Killen said. If he'd asked for an autopsy, he'd have gotten one. Despite a request that his court act expeditiously, Judge Bernard Brominski was giving no special consideration to the Denise petition, he said. I've got 16 other things on my desk to do, and I'm not going to be stampeded by what happens in other states. There was no danger of Brominski being stampeded into doing anything. Denise had again been tripped up on legal procedure. A mailed petition was inadmissible in a Pennsylvania court. Denise was obliged to present it in person. They are a lot more formal here than in Massachusetts, a chagrined Denise sought to cover up his mistake when he arrived in Wilkes Barre. Denise wasn't satisfied with the finding made at the scene of the accident. Dr. Mills' diagnosis of drowning was nothing more than a calculated guess. We did not overrule him. We should have, but we didn't. Denise hadn't interfered in the case, because it was a motor vehicle accident, and we did not want to accentuate and add to the confusion and hysteria that prevailed. Escorted into the courthouse through a basement door to avoid reporters, Denise was introduced to Judge Brominski. A stolid, hulking former college football player, Brominski was a party-line Democrat of limited judicial gifts who called him as he sees him on the bench. Denise took no encouragement at all from the bust of JFK on display in Brominski's chambers. After Denise agreed to bear expenses for any witnesses he intended bringing to Pennsylvania, his petition was granted a hearing. Brominski would weigh the public interest against the sanctity of the deceased in dealing with the case, by far the most interesting he'd handled in 11 years on the bench. It's rather exciting to be contacted by the national networks and other representatives of the news media, he said. Legally, I can't change my perspective. Obviously, I will give no special consideration to this decision than I would if it did not involve a United States senator. The publicity pleased Brominski because he came up for re-election in November, a fact clear enough to Denise, who observed posters advertising the judge's candidacy all over the place, even in the elevators of the courthouse. Scheduled for August 25th, the hearing would allow enough time to prepare for the inquest. Denise had made no decision about what witnesses he would call. Developments would determine whether Senator Kennedy would be asked to testify. Ordering an exhumation was always a difficult decision, but thousands of autopsies were routinely ordered by medical examiners and district attorneys every day, Denise said. It was his understanding Mrs. Kopechne had wanted an autopsy for her daughter but changed her mind. When she learned Denise was flying to Wilkes Barre to present his petition, Mrs. Kopechne telephoned attorney Joseph Flanagan. She was adamant in resisting exhumation of her daughter, Flanagan reported. She wants it blocked if at all possible. Denise had not given any good reason for wanting an autopsy, Mrs. Kopechne said. We can't understand why he waited so long to do this. He is only hurting us. I don't want my little girl's body dug up. My tiny, lovely baby. She'd never seen a doctor in her life, except for a little sinus drip a month ago. Mrs. Kopechne had accepted Senator Kennedy's failure to report the accident for more than 9 hours because he was in shock. But she questioned how he could appear in fresh clothes at the Shiretown Inn to ask the time several hours after the accident, and a possible conflict which had developed with the deputy sheriff regarding the time the accident had taken place. Reading all the different versions of what happened really gets you confused, she said. I would love to sit down and listen to the whole story, all of it pieced together, everything good and bad about how it happened. The young women who had attended the party hadn't revealed anything about the night her daughter was killed, she said. I guess those girls just aren't going to talk. It would ease the heartache so much if they could give us some answers. Mrs. Kopechne had heavy questions about the circumstances leading up to her daughter's death and afterward. The main question she wanted answered was the role Joseph Gargan and Paul Markham had played in the incident. She said, There's no sense denying it. I wonder what those men were doing. Why wasn't help called for my daughter? I can understand shock, but I don't see where they went into shock. It is this question that plagues me every day. Mrs. Kopechne was banking on an inquest to clear up the questions I have about Mary Jo's death. If other witnesses failed to answer those questions, I certainly would want Senator Kennedy to testify. Gargan didn't blame Mrs. Kopechne for questioning what he and Paul Markham did, he said. She didn't know what the real situation was. Hurtful and unwarranted as her remarks were, Gargan didn't seek to set the record straight. But Senator Kennedy couldn't tolerate criticism from a grieving parent in silence. Neither the senator nor his press aide were available to comment. Dunn Gifford was dispatched to Berkeley Heights with reassurances that the incident had been entirely innocent. The senator had left the party to give Mary Jo a lift to the ferry so she could return to her motel room. The damage control Gifford had practiced was so skillful, Joseph Kopechne explained several days later, his wife's remarks had been misinterpreted. She'd been upset when she said she wanted Senator Kennedy to testify at the inquest. What she meant was, we would be interested in hearing Senator Kennedy's testimony, if the district attorney feels it's necessary to call him. This is what we've believed all along. But defending against outbreaks of speculation about the entirely legitimate questions being raised about the accident was beyond even the capacity of the senator's skilled and tireless publicity apparatus to control. No sooner was one rumor stamped out, others sprang up in their place. On Wednesday, August 13th, the Manchester Union Leader reported Senator Kennedy had charged 17 long-distance telephone calls to his credit card during the hours he claimed to have been in shock after the accident. 5 calls had been made before midnight from the Lawrence Cottage, the first to the compound in Hyannisport lasting 21 minutes. Then 2 calls to Ted Sorensen and Burke Marshall. 12 calls had been made from the Shiretown Inn. Investigative reporter Arthur Egan had received the information from lawyer-realtor James Gilmartin of the Bronx, New York. Gilmartin claimed to have learned of the record of calls from a telephone company employee in accounting procedures. New England Telephone Company officials refused to confirm or deny the story. Federal regulations forbid the disclosure of the existence or contents of telephone calls except by court order, thereby giving credence to a story that was entirely false, but would attach permanently to the official history of the case. The record of calls charged to Senator Kennedy's credit card on July 18th to 19th, Egan claimed to have access to, would have shown none to have been made during the hours after the accident, or before Kennedy called Helga Wagner at the Shiretown Inn. Dick McCarron confirmed when he talked to telephone company attorney Bob Daly. I looked at some of their records, McCarron said later. Kennedy used a credit card issued by the Park Agency, Inc. of New York for calls made at the Chappaquiddick Landing and the police station, to keep the Senate stuff separate from the personal stuff. At least half a dozen people had access to the senator's telephone credit card, Dick Drain said, but I doubt that any of them made any calls that night. I think the whole story is a fabrication. Sorensen denied Kennedy had contacted him on the night of the accident. If he'd called me, I would have advised him immediately to do what he later realized he should have done, namely, go to the police promptly. Sorensen complained that some elements in the press were being unfair by printing lies and exaggerating rumors about the case. As the chief perpetrator of a misleading and now discredited television statement, Sorensen was in a position to know much of the misinformation about the case had been Kennedy created. The handling of the accident revived criticism of the Kennedy administration's penchant for news management in the form of repression and distortion, pressure and propaganda. Kenneth O'Donnell had repeatedly been mentioned in dispatches as having advised at the compound, despite his denials. We knew he wasn't there, so we didn't talk about it. We tried to stay away from discussing Chappaquiddick. Jimmy Smith recalled a meeting with O'Donnell at the Coonamessett Inn in Falmouth on August 15th. All Kenneth would say about Ted Kennedy was, he's got problems. His attitude was, we know what should have been done. They got shit on their shoe, let them handle it. The first Kennedy crisis O'Donnell would play no part in, after more than a decade as a leading member of the Irish Mafia, and a political chieftain, once described as the closest advisor and friend President Kennedy had in the White House. Like Sorensen, O'Donnell was seeking to use his service as a new frontiersman as a springboard for an independent political career. O'Donnell could best carry the torch of John Kennedy's philosophy in a state position in Massachusetts, he said, announcing his candidacy for governor at a 1966 friendship dinner in Boston. The non-political tribute to the man who had served the president was attended by Ted and Robert Kennedy, but spokesmen emphasized neither was endorsing O'Donnell's quest for office. In fact, Ted Kennedy was using the results of his own polling to persuade Robert Kennedy to tell his closest friend and former Harvard football teammate to drop out of the race. Ted's polls indicated O'Donnell couldn't win the nomination. Strictly a backroom operator, O'Donnell was a stiff, tight-lipped man of few words, a tense and interior personality that wouldn't come across as a candidate. Publicly, Kennedy intended to remain neutral in the contest, a stance Jimmy Smith had urged him to abandon by assuming party leadership in Massachusetts. Your brother is moving boldly in New York. He is popular because he is fighting and winning, Smith said. I'm constantly asked, what's the matter with Ted? Smith suggested, now is the time to support Kenneth O'Donnell. Ted Kennedy told him, why should I help Kenneth O'Donnell? What's he ever done that makes him so great? O'Donnell went dry in the mouth when Smith reported the conversation back, Smith said. Kenneth had made major contributions to both Jack and Bobby. He gave them his life. And it was coming down to rotten first-grade politics, the kind of thing the Kennedys had danced away from in Massachusetts for years. There wasn't a major decision that was made by President Kennedy during the period of 1961 to November 22, 1963, that Ken O'Donnell did not share in. O'Donnell's campaign literature quoted Robert Kennedy. O'Donnell ran a strong second to Ted Kennedy's old nemesis from 1962, Edward McCormick, in the primary. Kenneth made a strong effort and will be a future contender, Smith predicted. But relations between Ted Kennedy and O'Donnell remained strained. They clashed again when O'Donnell urged Robert Kennedy to run for president on the issue of ending the Vietnam War. Dunn Gifford said, Teddy didn't believe you should use up what capital you had on a moral issue. As political coordinator of the states in that campaign, O'Donnell spoke with Robert Kennedy by phone minutes before he descended to the Ambassador Hotel ballroom in Los Angeles to accept victory in the California presidential primary. Devastated by the assassination, O'Donnell observed, that's 2 out of 2 now. That's a hell of an average for the Red Sox, but it's not very good in this business. Rather than auction his political acumen to the highest bidder in Washington, O'Donnell returned to Massachusetts for a second try for governor in 1970. Smith was affronted to learn at the meeting to prepare for the campaign that Ted Kennedy intended to remain neutral again. O'Donnell could expect nothing by way of support. But O'Donnell had no such expectations. With the shadow of Chappaquiddick dimming the political horizon, Ted Kennedy had his own backyard to cultivate. O'Donnell had a pretty good idea why his advice hadn't been sought about the accident. Unlike Gargan, Paul Markham was not bearing his withering characterization about the role he had played in the accident in silence. Cleo O'Donnell, Kenneth's older brother, recalled, "Paul was calling Kenny up to talk about the accident, not for Teddy, but for himself." Being a former U.S. attorney, the leading federal law enforcement officer in Massachusetts, it didn't look good for him not to know enough to report an accident. Paul wasn't comfortable with the situation he was in, but he was stuck with Teddy's story. Kenny knew it went on because Paul told him. Kenneth O'Donnell confided what he would have done in the circumstances Markham described. Kenny would have knocked Teddy out cold at the landing when he didn't want to report the accident, then called the Coast Guard, the U.S. Marines, you name it, and had Teddy taken to a hospital with serious head injuries, Cleo said. Maybe the girl could have been saved, maybe not. But Teddy would have been all right. The thing would have been reported. That's what the problem was, not the accident itself, but running away and leaving Joey Gargan and Paul Markham holding the bag like that to save himself. In Cleo's view, Teddy Kennedy was the weak kitten in the litter, never able to measure up to his brothers. The accident at Chappaquiddick had been illustrative of a chronic immaturity, Cleo said. One problem Teddy always had was keeping it in his pants, even when other people are around. The senator's television speech was nothing more than a sob story, Cleo said. Kenny was amazed Teddy's people had allowed him to make it. He blamed Ted Sorensen. There was no love lost between them. They never hit it off. Nevertheless, Kenneth O'Donnell called the Boston Bureau of the Associated Press to register support for Ted Kennedy. "I think he should stay on. I'd be very disappointed if he didn't," O'Donnell said. "I thought he showed tonight the kind of courage his brothers showed." Jimmy Smith was shocked when he learned of the endorsement. How do you think Teddy Kennedy felt when Kenneth said that about courage, knowing what he'd been saying about him? It was the perfect political backhand. Like saying, "Now you owe me one. See, I'm not such a bad guy." Smith was convinced O'Donnell could have saved the situation had he been called to the compound the week after the accident. Kenneth was a moral man. His presence alone would have set some of those guys advising back light years. But Smith had intuited another reason O'Donnell hadn't been asked. Kenneth was drinking a little bit, so they didn't want him around, the powers close to the throne. They thought they had the next president of the United States all to themselves. And what they did was, they left Teddy Kennedy as a guy who would never be president. Because if he couldn't handle a fucking automobile accident, how could he handle anything else? Chapter 40. The handling of the accident hadn't impressed Paul Redmond, retained with his law partner Daniel Daly to represent 8 witnesses at the scheduled inquest. "I thought the meetings Ted Kennedy had at Hyannisport with the so-called Wonder Boys had been a disaster," Redmond said. "I remember Ted Sorensen being asked, 'What were you doing at the compound?' And him saying, 'Well, I was just there to make sure he didn't lie.' I thought that was the classic example of, 'Lord, deliver me from my friends.'" Redmond hadn't thought much of the speech Sorensen had composed either, he said. "When I became involved in the case, I very carefully went back and reread it. The statement was aimed at the elements of manslaughter, sobriety and reckless driving. The rest of it was strictly PR." A classmate of Ted Kennedy's at Harvard, Redmond was a brilliant trial attorney. "I was representing 3 guys and 5 very young girls. When I got the case, it was a circus. There was tremendous speculation, a lot of rumor and gross untruth being printed in the newspapers. These girls had been put through the ringer," Redmond said. "For all the vaunted Kennedy PR machine, I was amazed no one ever came forward to say loud and clear that these girls had worked for Robert Kennedy. Not only had there been previous reunions, they had been at Ted's house when Joan was there as hostess. That was the proper background and setting for the party at Chappaquiddick.
These weren't six high-priced international jet-set hookers flown in from all over the world for Ted's carnal amusement at the party.
Redmond dismissed the idea of a Kennedy brain trust plotting strategies, he said. Everybody was talking about the defense of this case being framed and postured by all these high-powered lawyers at the compound, but there was never any of that. The fact was, this case was being handled by guys who had tried literally thousands of criminal cases. We were not only very experienced trial lawyers, we had lived in Massachusetts our whole lives, so we knew the names and numbers of all the players. We were not unaware that District Attorney Denise liked to bask in the sunlight of publicity, that he was prone to making statements both in and out of the courtroom.
What Denise said outside the courtroom, Redmond had no control over. But I was going to make goddamn sure when I went into that inquest that I knew exactly what was going to happen. I'm not walking in there blind.
The first thing a trial lawyer wanted to know, never mind the facts of the case or the law, Redmond said, was what are the rules of the game going to be? Nobody knows anything about inquests. The only two cases on the books were railroad accidents, dating to the late 1800s. Redmond was drafting a letter to Judge Boyle, requesting a conference, to find out what kind of proceeding he was going to run. Redmond wanted to know whether lawyers would be present to advise clients during their testimony, and be allowed to object to questions put to them and other witnesses. Redmond said, "If I get over there with no ground rules, and some local gossip gets up on the witness stand and starts spouting off material she's convinced herself is true because her third cousin's aunt flew over Chappaquiddick at 10,000 feet, I want the right to cross-examine to protect my clients' reputations. That's the reason I'm asking for things like the right of confrontation and the right to present evidence. Christ, I'm not going into a courtroom where I can't do anything but just sit there." Redmond was scouting the legal terrain, seeking to locate an appealable issue to sabotage the inquest and tempt Judge Boyle into a legal snare. Boyle wasn't bound by law to hold hearings or entertain argument prior to an inquest, a procedure known to any lawyer as a judicial investigation into a death that did not require a defense, since no one was accused of any crime. Nor was an inquest a case calling for the pretrial maneuvering of a criminal prosecution. A copy of Redmond's letter delivered to the district attorney's office prompted Armand Fernandez to inquire if Redmond intended to produce his clients voluntarily at the inquest. Redmond regarded the ground rules as the first order of business, he said. He wouldn't say whether his clients would volunteer or not. But Redmond was stalling, and Fernandez knew it. He said, "There was some question about extraditing out-of-state people as witnesses to an inquest, if that could be done. The four Washington girls couldn't be subpoenaed except through a long, drawn-out legal process. That's why the inquest situation came up in the first place. The idea was, Kennedy's lawyers would cooperate. If that didn't work to get the witnesses to talk, we would have gone to a grand jury, something Kennedy's people greatly feared. So word just sort of went out about voluntarily appearing, responding to a summons, or facing a grand jury subpoena." By going with an inquest, Fernandez thought Denise had outfoxed the opposition. In lieu of subpoenas, the district attorney's office was sending registered letters with return receipts, asking those who had attended the party at Chappaquiddick to appear at the inquest, without further notice from this office. Fernandez recalled, "There was no overwhelming response." If Redmond refused to disclose what his intentions were, one of his clients did it for him. A gamine-like young woman, and former aide to Robert Kennedy, Rosemary Keough evinced a sophistication about her legal position well beyond her 23 years. Although not required to answer a summons, if she was invited by Massachusetts authorities, "I will voluntarily agree to testify at any legal proceedings in regard to the case," she said. "I will answer all questions fully and cooperatively." Keough denied guests at the cookout had left Martha's Vineyard to avoid interrogation about the accident. She would have been glad to answer questions if police had asked her any. None did. Neither Senator Kennedy, his aides, nor anyone else had suggested directly or indirectly that she not discuss the party. "Those rumors are untrue and false and very unfair," she said. "Mary Jo's death was an accident, of that I am sure.
There is nothing to hide or cover up. I can't understand all the mysterious aspects